Before we get into today's episode, I want to invite you on a unique spiritual journey this Advent season. It's called Journey to Bethlehem, and it's a free 9-day text message series designed to prepare your heart for Christmas. Starting on December the 17th, each day leading up to Christmas, you'll receive a short reflective message pointing you to the hope, peace, joy, and love found in the coming of Christ. It's completely free and a great way to keep your focus on Jesus this season. Why not sign up today at premierinsight.org/resources? That's premierinsight.org/resources. Now, here's today's podcast.
Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Hello everyone, Tim here. Just a quick note to say that today's episode is going to be a little bit different. A few weeks back, Dad was invited to Belfast in Northern Ireland to give the Church of Ireland's annual lecture. It was entitled Autonomy, Suffering and Human Dignity, Theological and Medical Responses to Assisted Dying. And in it, he reflects on the current moves we're seeing towards assisted dying, and in particular, what we as Christians believe about the ethical and spiritual dimensions to suffering. What are the strengths and weaknesses of the arguments, both from autonomy and compassion, used by those in favour of legalising medical assisted suicide? And what richer, deeper story about human dependence and dignity can Christians tell in response to this? After the lecture, there was also a time of questions and response with those in the audience at Queen's University in Belfast. I hope you enjoy.
Well, thank you so much for that warm welcome and for those very kind words from Professor Miles. It's a privilege for me to be here and to tackle what are some extremely challenging and difficult issues. Just to say that the QR code is for Slido, which will allow you to type questions, use a smartphone. If you aim at the QR code and then press the little yellow box that should appear, that should take you to Slido. And as we go through, if you would like to put in a question or a comment, and also you can see what other people questions that they have asked, and then I'm going to speak for about 40 minutes, 45 minutes max, and then there'll be a time for discussion. We don't call it Q&A any longer because this is seemed to be patronising. It's called Q&R, question and response. So we, you know, there are no answers, but we'll have responses. So, autonomy, suffering, and human dignity. One of the Enlightenment philosophers said that death, like the sun, should not be stared at. And yet, that's exactly what we're going to be doing this evening. We're going to be staring at death, at dying, at issues to do with suicide, suffering at the end of life, autonomy, human dignity. It's going to be a bundle of laughs, as you can see. But seriously, I'm very well aware that these are not just academic, philosophical, theological issues. These are issues which touch all of us at a very deep and personal level. And I'm absolutely certain that many people in this room, you will have watched a loved one die slowly, sometimes painfully, and had first-hand experience of that. Or you may even have a terminal diagnosis yourself, and are wondering what the future will hold and how you will die, and so on. And many of us, including myself, will have had episodes where we've faced depression and suicidal thoughts and desires to end your own life. So these are issues which touch all of us. And I think, therefore, whenever we discuss them, we need to remember that. We're not just talking about interesting philosophy. We're talking about a deeply human and personal issues. Now, as you're all well aware, going through the UK Parliament at the moment is this bill with the strange title, Terminally Ill Adults End of Life Bill. And if you saw that title, you wouldn't immediately think that was about killing people, but that's exactly what it is. And it's one of the factors about this debate, as we as something that I've been involved with over many years. It's always struck me about the fact that very often euphemistic and sometimes, frankly, misleading language is used. There's a very powerful lobby that's dedicated to changing the law, and in particularly on the mainland, it's Dignity in Dying, the Campaign for Dignity in Dying. This is Kim Leadbeater, who's the MP who steered it through Parliament, the bill. And Dignity in Dying is a very well-funded and very effective organisation. And if you go onto their website, you can see there are key words which appear time and time again. They are choice, control. Giving choice includes giving mentally competent, terminally ill adults in unbearable suffering the choice of an assisted death with strict legal safeguards, a dignified death for all, patient choice at the end of life. And it's interesting looking around the world to see how the debate about assisted suicide and euthanasia so often uses these kind of euphemistic titles and phrases: dignified death, the right to die, the right to choose, easing the passing, assisted dying, medical aid at the end of life, death with dignity, and so on. And from a strictly legal point of view, these are all phrases employed to describe the intentional destruction of human life, actions which were previously defined legally as either homicide, the destruction of a human life by another person, or suicide, the destruction of one's own life. And up until now, in English law, the legal situations in which life could be intentionally destroyed have been extremely limited. They've included judicial execution. They've included combat and warfare, highly controversially, and under they have included the security services occasionally. But the total number of those whose lives have been ended by a legal process in England and Wales has been extremely limited over the past centuries. But if this legislation passes into law, then we can anticipate there are actually going to be thousands of people whose lives are going to be intentionally ended in a legally approved process in England, English jurisdiction. And that, I think, does represent a landmark, which is therefore worth considering. As you are probably aware, this law has passed its stages in the House of Commons. It's now currently being reviewed in the House of Lords. And if it is passed, ultimately, it's likely to pass into law within the next 4 to 5 years. If we look across the world just to see what happens, in Canada, and here we have another euphemistic title, medical aid in dying, which is actually a description for what is a lethal injection. In 95% of cases in Canada, it's an intravenous lethal injection given by a doctor or a specialised nurse. And if you can see, it was introduced in 2016, how there's been this very significant increase year on year, which seems to be continuing on. And in fact, in the latest figures in 2023, 4.7% of all deaths were now through euthanasia. And in certain areas, particularly in Quebec, it was over 7%. And if you ask the reasons, people are asked to give reasons as to why they are requesting or receiving aid, you can see straight away that down there, the ones I've highlighted. So at the bottom, it's the most common at the bottom of the going up. I'm sorry if it's rather small. But basically, this says loss of ability to engage in meaningful activities at the bottom, the most common. Loss of ability to perform activities of daily living. And then loss of dignity. I've circled that as we come back to it. Inadequate pain control or concern about it. Loss of independence. perceived burden on family, friends, or caregivers, and so on. Loss of control of bodily functions is there. So if you think of the rhetoric, which is so often about hopeless and unbearable suffering, the image that is given into people's minds is of people screaming in agony of being, and in fact we've heard tragic cases of people, including cases in Parliament, who were tragic cases of people apparently in total agony, crying out in pain, and repeatedly it said, and the doctors can do nothing. And this, when you compare that with what we see here as the reasons given for why people are receiving euthanasia in Canada, you can see that there's actually a very marked mismatch, and that pain is not the principal issue, and it's much more concerned about activities of life and about this great concern about loss of dignity or being a burden on others. So that's Canada. This is statistics from the state of Oregon in the USA. Here's another euphemism. This is the DWDA, which stands for the Death with Dignity Act. And this, in Oregon, it's only oral means of assisted suicide which are prescribed. But as you can see, there is this remarkable trend for increasing numbers year on year. There's really no impression that a plateau has been reached as to what the demand was once the law is passed. So I think just to step back a bit, I think something that strikes me, certainly as a clinician and as a paediatrician, is how there has been a whole sea change in the general population's understanding of death. And of course, we only have to go back really before the Second World War, when the reality was that death was a tragic but very normal and common part of everyone's life. Most deaths took place at the home, and most family members would have witnessed the deaths both of adults, including young adults as well as older adults, and, well, many children, babies, children, adolescents, and so on. And it's really only since the Second World War that the dying process has been increasingly medicalized. It's been taken out of the home, and it's moved into hospitals and institutions. Now, most people die in hospitals or other institutions surrounded by anonymous professionals. And most ordinary people have never seen a dead body, and they haven't watched someone die. And so, except, of course, everybody has witnessed hundreds, if not thousands, of simulated deaths in films, in social media, in computer games and so on. So there's a vast, in horror films, you think of the horrific, the deaths which everybody's witnessed, contrasted with the fact they've never actually seen a real human being die. It's easy to see how images of what the dying process is like are very common. And interestingly, there's a recurring theme that happens when people are dying and the relatives are around the bed and involved. It's often the distress of the relatives which is driving concern rather than the person themselves. And it's often because the relatives who've never witnessed this before feel, you've got to do something, Doc. You know, you've got to solve this problem. So these are complex waters to do with our own human experiences. And related to that is that periods of vulnerability and fragility and dependence on others have always been part of human experience. It's part of the human condition. It's part of the common experience of humanity. They are part of the narrative of every human life. I mean, you came into this world utterly and totally dependent on the love and care of other people. And frankly, if they hadn't looked after you and kept you warm and fed you and protected you, you wouldn't be sitting on that seat. The very fact you survived is because somebody cared for you when you were born. And then we go through a period of our lives where most of us are caring for other people. My wife, we're the parents of three boys, six grandchildren. A lot of our life is spent in trying to care for other people, providing resources and just day-to-day care and so on. But most of us are going to end our lives utterly and totally dependent on the care and the love and the protection of other human beings. And that, in the past, has never been seen as an outrage, as a horror, as a terrible reality. It's always previously been seen as part of the human condition. So why now should we regard these experiences as fundamentally undignified, as unacceptable, and therefore a rational and legally supported reason for self-destruction? Because the implication of dying with dignity, of having a dignified death, is that you cannot have a dignified death unless you take your own life. Because otherwise, other people are caring for you, and that is somehow a loss of dignity. So dignity is a complex and challenging world. But one way of thinking about it is to divide it into two categories. There is intrinsic dignity, and there is attributed dignity. And intrinsic dignity is the ineradicable value that every human life carries. And in traditional, certainly Christian and also Greco-Roman thinking and elsewhere, influenced by Christian revelation, it is inalienable. It cannot be taken away. And human dignity in this way of thinking is radically egalitarian. Everyone has the same dignity. There aren't degrees of human dignity. It's ultimately absolutely the same from the tiny preterm babies that I used to look after all the way through to the elderly person with dementia, this ineradicable human dignity. And it points to the concept that every human being, whatever their abilities, their capabilities, is a full member of the human community. So that's intrinsic dignity. Attributed dignity is a value we confer on others or onto our own lives. And it varies in degree. Your attributed dignity can go up or down. You can feel that you've lost your dignity by the way that other people treat you. It rises or falls depending on the attitudes and actions of others and on the perceptions, our own perceptions of our own status. So according to the Christian ethical tradition, illness, dependence, and the dying process cannot alter or diminish our intrinsic dignity. But I think a lot of the confusion and a lot of the way that this word is used in this debate is about talking about attributed dignity. I've lost my dignity. And so I think it's something that we need to recognize, particularly those of us who are carers. As carers, we are called to respect our patients' intrinsic dignity and treat them with compassion, gentleness, and respect. We acknowledge the perceived indignities, which is the attributed dignity, but we have a moral duty to enhance the attributed dignity, to treat them with respect, the attributed dignity of dying persons. So that's the complex and contested concept of dignity. You can see how it works both ways. Both sides in this debate are often appealing to dignity, but what they're appealing to are fundamentally different concepts. What about autonomy, the capacity for self-governance? Greek autonomos, which you could translate as I make my own laws, as opposed to heteronomy, which is when other people make laws for me. And of course, crudely, my body, my choice. And of course, this is remarkably central to the heart of all modern medical care. It's at the heart of the NHS, patient choice, something we're all instructed in as clinicians. We have to respect patients' choices, but patients don't have unfettered choice, unfettered autonomy when it comes to medical treatment. Because as clinicians, as doctors, we have a moral and legal duty to act in our patients' best interests. And that means I, as a doctor, can only give you a treatment if I'm absolutely convinced that it's in your best interest, if I'm convinced that the benefits of the treatment are going to outweigh the burdens, if the treatment is properly evidence-based, if it's been approved for use. Those are the only treatments that I can give. Even if you ask for treatment, I can't give it to you if it doesn't meet those criteria and if I genuinely don't believe it's in your best interests. But what is being proposed is that assisted suicide, assisted dying, is going to be a treatment option. And then the question comes, can I as a physician believe that ending your life is genuinely in your best interests? Is this a treatment which has been approved? There's a slightly surreal discussion going on in the medical profession about what to even call the substances that are being used to kill people. Slightly grisly aside here, but when the euthanasia doctors first started killing their patients, they didn't know how to do it. It wasn't the sort of thing you got taught in medical school. And so there were some very grisly experiments when the doctors tried to kill people, experimenting with different techniques, such as injecting large quantities of air into veins, giving huge amounts of insulin, getting them to breathe various toxic gases, and so on. Eventually, the euthanasia doctors have worked out a very effective way of killing, which is intravenously, which is using massive doses of very old drugs called barbiturates. The dose that is used is sometimes 50 to 100 times the normal therapeutic dose. And then coupled with other agents which are designed to stop breathing and so on, these work at the end of the needle. Apparently, when it comes to oral drugs, which is what is going to be suggested in England and Wales, so intravenous drugs will not be used. It will be a question to patients taking oral lethal medication. Again, there is ongoing experimentation going on in other places like Oregon to find out what's the best way of giving what are the best kind of lethal combination of drugs to take by mouth. And there's been a move away from barbiturates because there was a distressing frequency of people failing to die when they were, including waking up and sometimes inhaling and aspirating. They're currently, the commonest drugs are actually a very potent mix of a cardiotoxic group of drugs, which are designed to cause cardiac arrest, to work directly on the heart. The point is that none of these treatments have ever been properly tested or approved. There have been no controlled trials, you'll be surprised to hear. There have been no sort of testing of different dosage regimes. There's no evidence base. And we're not even sure, what do we call them? Can we call these medication? But they're not really medicines, the way they're being used. So the current agreement is these should be called lethal substances. But again, how are they going to be regulated? Are pharmacists going to... the patient indication sheet going to say? What are the recommended doses? And so on. You can just see the can of worms that is opening up here. I do want to say something about suicide prevention, something which we're so used to we don't really notice, is the extraordinary lengths to which we as a society go to prevent people taking their own lives. I went onto the internet and looked for a number of images of people who were being restrained from jumping off bridges and so on like that. But I decided in the end it was sort of unpleasant and manipulative to show these images, but you can imagine the images. So the question is, there was a striking image of someone trying to jump off a bridge into the Thames from London, and anonymous strangers were holding on to this person, trying to hold on to them and prevent them from jumping into the Thames. And it's quite routine to send up paramedics and police people and so on to take enormous risks with their own lives to try and stop a stranger who is perched on a bridge somewhere or on top of a building. So why do we as a society put such enormous emphasis in trying to prevent people, strangers, from committing suicide? And yet it's something that every professional, every doctor, every nurse, every police officer, every prison officer, every social worker, we're all trained in suicide prevention. We're all trained in how to spot the possible signs of suicide and how to do anything we can. And in fact, medically speaking, if someone is threatening to commit suicide, that is a medical emergency, and I have the right to restrain them and get them admitted to the accident and emergency department, because it's a medical emergency. And yet, we now have legislation which is designed to help people commit suicide, a certain subset of people. Now, how can we understand that? And the way that it is argued is to try to draw a logical distinction between what is called a rational suicide and an irrational suicide. And so the current guidance would say that a rational suicide is someone who has a terminal illness with 6 months to live. Why 6 months? Clawed out of the air. What about 3 months or 9 months or 4.5 months? It's 6 months. If it's less than 6 months, it's rational. If it's more than 6 months, it's not. They have to have intact mental and legal capacity. They have to have no evidence of mental illness. They have to have a so-called well-founded or settled will to kill themselves. They must be aware of alternative options for care, and there must be lack of any coercion, any manipulation. In fact, it is said, any influence from others. This is entirely an individual choice to end my own life. Now, of course, all of those criteria are contestable, and it's very hard to see what the rational basis is for all of those. Indeed, the idea that a busy doctor under pressure is going to be able to work out the final, whether the degree of coercion, manipulation, influence from others. In fact, it's frankly totally incomprehensible to suggest. We're all of us influenced by other people, aren't we? We're all of us constantly influenced by our closest friends and relatives. The idea that it's possible to abstract any possible influence from other people to an isolated, individualistic decision to kill yourself, I think is laughable, but nonetheless, that is what is being proposed. Professor, now Lord Nigel Biggar, says that the notion that we're all rational choosers is a flattering lie told us by people who want to sell us something. And a very distinguished commentator, Honora O'Neill, says this: in a world of idealized, wholly autonomous patients and of wholly selfless and compassionate families and professionals, legislation might not be risky. But we do not live in that world, and I doubt whether we can draft legislation that is safe for human beings with the full variety of situations and dependence on one another. So that's the argument from autonomy. The other argument, which is very frequently raised and is heard, is the argument from compassion. We have a moral duty to respond to the cries for help from people who are, quotes, dying in agony. Surely you'd put a dog out of their misery? How much more should compassion drive us to end the suffering? But compassion is not as straightforward as it sounds. In fact, the more you go into it, the more slippery the concept of compassion is. So if compassion is a reason for ending someone's life, why can't we have compassion on someone with dementia who's in terrible pain and suffering? Why can't we have some compassion with somebody with brain damage at the end of their life? Why can't we have compassion with somebody with profoundly suffering because of severe, untreatable mental illness? Why can't we have compassion on children? Surely the suffering of children is even more significant. Why can't we have compassion on babies? But when we see terrible suffering in all these categories, apparently we're called to harden our hearts and say, well, I'm sorry, but that's tough. But if you're suffering and you have a terminal illness with less than 6 months and you're mentally confident, that's different. Now I can have compassion on you. Now I can treat you with compassion. It's a very selective and strange kind of inconsistent kind of compassion. In fact, with an analogy which I know I use with some trepidation, but in the war trials, the Nuremberg war trials after the Nazi end of the Second World War, it was Brandt, who was the head of the euthanasia program, which the Third Reich was operating, when challenged in Nuremberg as to why he was doing this, his answer was, it was compassion. These were lives that were not worth living, and we were acting compassionately. So it's a more closer to home argument, and that is I've had the privilege of knowing a number of people with quite severe chronic disabling conditions who from time to time have an acute exacerbation and get admitted to hospital with a chest infection or something else like that. And you know, most of the people who I know like this are terrified about going into an NHS hospital. And they're terrified because in their illness, some junior doctor will have compassion on them and decide that their life is not worth living. So your compassion, quotes, can threaten my life. That's why compassion, which is not bounded in a moral framework, is actually dangerous. When I was a junior doctor, I thought that everyone over 60 years was suffering from impending senility and decay, and I'd be doing them a favour to gently ease them out of their life. Now I'm well over that age. It's strange how my perspective has rather changed. And then, of course, there are social pressures, increasing demand for euthanasia and assisted suicide. We all know there's an aging population. We know there's a rise in chronic disability. There are rising healthcare costs. There's family breakup and social isolation. There's increasing demands on society. And as H.L. Mencken said, there's always an easy solution to every human problem: neat, plausible, and wrong. And that's what I think, that ultimately it's neat, it's plausible, but it's wrong. But behind it, you know, there are some deep questions. What does it mean to die well and to die faithfully? If I was to do a survey, certainly if you go out into the street and you were to ask people, how would you like to die? You know what the answer is going to be. I would like to die in my bed at night. I don't want any premonition. I don't want any warning. I just want to go to bed one night and then, pew, gone. Wouldn't that be a wonderful way to die? The interesting thing is, if you were to go back several hundred years and ask people, sudden, unexpected death like that was seen as the worst possible way to die. In fact, there's an ancient prayer in the Church of England against sudden death. So isn't it interesting that sudden death that was seen as a horror to be prayed against is now transformed as to an ideal way to die? I mean, to be catapulted into eternity with no possibility of preparing to meet your maker, no possibility of asking forgiveness for your sins, no possibility of saying goodbye to your loved ones, no possibility of making preparation for those who are going to be left behind. No possibility of encouraging other people, just to go bang with no warning. What a terrible way to die. So it's interesting, isn't it, how attitudes towards death have changed. But sadly or unsadly, it's actually very rare to die in your bed at night with no warning. The majority of people in this country die often in one of these two ways, which are horrible ways to die. On the left, there's failed cardiopulmonary resuscitation. On their right, there's death in an intensive care unit. It wouldn't be true to say the majority, but it would be true to say that a very significant number of people do die like that. In fact, over 50% of all deaths happen in an NHS, general hospital, surrounded by anonymous professionals.
Have you ever found yourself wondering if it's still possible to have civil conversations in today's culture wars? That's exactly why we want to send you a brand new and exclusive booklet called Arguing for the Sake of Heaven, a look at the life and legacy of Charlie Kirk. This compelling resource reflects on Charlie's legacy and the controversies he sparked, but more importantly, it explores how we can recover the art of disagreeing agreeably. In a polarized world, how do we defend free speech, speak the truth in love, and pursue truth without fear? I believe this is a resource that every thoughtful Christian should have. And right now, it's our special thanks to you for your gift to Premier Insight. Your support helps ensure that content like this podcast and so many others continue reaching people who are searching for wisdom, truth, and hope. So I encourage you to give today by visiting premierinsight.org/matters of life and death. That's premierinsight.org/matters of life and death to receive your copy today. Now, let's get back to today's episode.
You're listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
And so I think the question of what it means to die well and how we would like to die, dying well doesn't happen by accident. It's something that we have to plan for and prepare for and discuss with our loved ones. I'll come back to that at the end, just before we finish. I love this Chinese proverb. The beginning of wisdom is to call things by their proper names, which is why I think that this euphemistic terms like assisted dying are really so dangerous. And so in terms of definition, euthanasia is intentional killing using lethal medication as part of medical care. And physician-assisted suicide is intentional killing. The doctor intends that the patient will die. The doctor chooses the lethal medication. The doctor calculates the lethal dose, gets the drugs, explains to the patient how to use them, hands them over, explains how they need to, the precautions they need to take, and so on. But in the end, it's the patient who has to take the drugs. But the intention of the doctor is that the patient will die. And that is not the same as withdrawing medical treatment, which is futile or burdensome, or where the patient is actively dying. So the withdrawal of futile and burdensome treatment is good medical practice, something which has been part of medical practice since the dawn of history. And the way we do that is by balancing the benefits and the burdens of treatment. So medical treatment, which is bringing benefits greater than its burdens, is something that we have a duty to give. Medical treatment whose burdens are greater than the benefits, we have a duty to withdraw. To carry on giving ineffective and damaging treatment is actually abusive and is something, unfortunately, which is very common in the NHS, with this over-medicalization of patients receiving massive but futile and burdensome treatments right to the end of life. And in fact, sadly, that's one of the drives towards legalizing assisted suicide, because of the medical overtreatment, which is so common. Why is it happening? That's something perhaps we could discuss later on. It's a complex and toxic mix of inexperienced doctors, worry about being sued, and so on and so on. Moving on, So therefore, good medicine must know its limits. It must know when to say enough is enough. It must recognise when death changes from an enemy to be resisted into a gateway to a new existence, even a strange form of healing, a severe mercy. So what would be the likely consequences if this legislation is passed in England? Well, I think we underestimate the significances of how this will spread across the NHS. What it will mean is it's a therapeutic option for every person with approximately 6 months or less to live. There will be the creation of formal care pathways. The most important thing is to avoid a postcode lottery. That means every single hospital, every single wherever NHS care is given, we've got to make sure that this option is made available. There'll be the risk of legal action if eligible patients are not informed. There'll have to be training for all health professionals in the techniques. They'll have to document that the conversation has been held and what the result was. There'll be pressures on hospices and palliative care services to introduce this into their services and so on. And once the legal option exists, I have to provide a justification for wanting to continue to live. You mean you didn't have it? You know, you were offered it, weren't you? And you didn't choose? You know, why was that? So the paradox is that once an option is in place, then I have to have some kind of justification for continuing. Okay, coming towards the end and thinking particularly from a Christian perspective, this is slightly simplistic, but I think it's a foundation of truth that Christian ethics, the way we're called to treat one another, comes from Christian anthropology, the way we've been created. And so the fundamental resistance to assisted suicide is from Christian anthropology. In Christian thinking, a human life is not just a gift of God's grace, but actually it's a reflection of his being, of his character, the imago Dei. And this is brought out in this famous verse from the beginning of in Genesis: whoever sheds the blood of man, by man shall his blood be shed, for in the image of God has God made man. So in this ancient text, the Lex Talionis, which is thought to be one of the most ancient of all legal dictums, the primeval human taboo against the shedding of blood is linked with the image of God, with the imago Dei. In Christian thinking, the destruction of human life is always wrong, not only because of the wrong to the individual and the community, but also because it is a profound insult to the being and character of God himself. An intentional killing of an innocent human being is wrong because it contravenes the profound moral order which lies behind the structure of the universe and which is written in our hearts. And an example of this is the studies that have been done in doctors who carry out euthanasia in other countries. And it's been shown that there's a very significant incidence of moral distress of people who say, I have flashbacks, I don't like doing it, it feels bad. And I think that is a marker of this, of the moral order that is, even if we don't recognize it, is nonetheless written in our hearts, to put it that way. But it's also striking that although suicide in many non-Christian cultures is often seen as an honorable and a noble way to die, in the biblical narrative, and in fact in all societies influenced by Christianity, suicide has never been glorified as a noble or honorable way to die. It's always seen as an act of despair, of hopelessness. You think of Judas Iscariot or of King Saul in the Old Testament. And yet, suicidal thoughts are common in God's people. Job curses the day he was born. Elijah wishes to die, but is sent on a sabbatical instead. So suicidal thoughts are common, but that suicide itself is never honoured or glorified as a noble or a godly way to die. And in the beautiful poem John Donne, no man is an island entire of itself. Every man is a piece of the continent, a part of the main. Any man's death diminishes me because I am involved in mankind. And therefore never send to know for whom the bell tolls. It tolls for thee. So the death of human beings is not to be welcomed and hastened. Death is an enemy which we fight against. But death can also become a strange kind of healing, a gateway to a new reality. So there's this strange ambivalence, it seems to me, in the Christian moral tradition that we fight against death as an evil to be held at bay and not welcomed and not hastened. And yet there is a time to take one's hands away and allow death to occur naturally. And that was the great insight of Cicely Saunders, remarkable Christian physician, who really almost single-handedly invented a new way of caring for dying people. She said, you matter because you are you, and you matter to the end of your life. Not only will we help you to die well, we'll help you to live before you die. And that became a slogan of the movement. And she famously said, you don't have to kill the patient in order to kill the pain. But her wonderful insight was that suffering at the end of life was much more than physical pain. And if there's nothing else that you remember from this lecture, could you please try and remember this? Because there is still a huge lack of understanding of this basic point. Most people think that suffering at the end of life, when people are crying out in agony, it must be because of just overwhelming physical pain, like biliary colic or an untreated fracture that's just at the agony, make it stop. What Cicely Saunders realized was that that was just one component of suffering at the end of the life. But in fact, there was also psychological pain, anxiety, depression, all kinds of stuff going on in people's heads. There's relational pain, broken relationships to do, and there's spiritual pain or existential pain to do with guilt, to do with loss of meaning, purposelessness. That's what came out in those statistics from Canada. That was what people were expressing there, was spiritual and relational and psychological pain or suffering, this deep existential angst. And what Cicely Saunders recognized is that you have to treat pain at all four levels. Yes, you treat the physical pain with the very best that we have available, but you also treat the psychological, relational, and spiritual aspects. And she demonstrated time and time again that that was remarkably successful. And that's what palliative care doctors will tell you, that when it's done properly and when you recognise all the elements of the existential distress that's here, you can make a huge difference. And one of the slogans which came out of the palliative care movement and which I've found extremely helpful is this one: suffering is not a question which demands an answer. It's not a problem which demands a solution. It's a mystery which demands a presence. Ultimately, suffering can just not be annihilated, wiped away. But we can walk alongside those who are suffering. We can give them the very best of our care. We can treat the physical, psychological, relational, and spiritual elements. And that's our calling. That's what we're called to. So I'm coming to the end. I'll close with this. Words from the Catholic philosopher Joseph Piper. Love is a way of saying to another, it's good that you exist. It's good that you're in the world. Unfortunately, suicide, assisted suicide and euthanasia says exactly the opposite. It says, you know what? I agree with you. It's bad that you exist. It'd be much better if you didn't exist. But genuine love, it is argued, always says, it's good that you exist. It's good that you're in the world. If you're interested in following up some more of these ideas, these are some books. I have some copies here just to wave if you're interested. Want to look at them. I have a website called johnwyatt.com. And I also do a podcast with my son called Matters of Life and Death, which you can find on any podcast provider. But thank you so much for listening. And I hope what you will maybe do is turn to your neighbor and discuss with them what questions you would like to raise. And that's the QR code.
So, Professor Wyatt, what happens to palliative care in jurisdictions which legalise assisted suicide? And what should we do to preserve inherent intrinsic dignity?
Yes, thanks. So, you won't be surprised to hear that the very large majority of palliative care doctors in this country and in fact, historically around the world, have been strongly opposed to assisted suicide and euthanasia. And certainly in the original philosophy of palliative care, as it was envisaged by Cicely Saunders, it was clear that the whole philosophy was that you neither attempted to hasten death, nor did you attempt to slow down and keep people alive. What you did was you allowed death to occur naturally as much as possible, according to natural processes, while you focus, the whole palliative care team focuses on maximizing the quality of those final hours, days, weeks. Sadly, what has happened around where jurisdictions where this has been passed is there has been a huge amount of pressure, particularly from the pro-euthanasia lobby, to say that palliative care centres should provide this as a, quote, service, so that if patients are admitted into a palliative care institution, they should have the right, if they wished, to access assisted suicide. And it's been very difficult to protect palliative care services from this onslaught. And so it would be true to say, in many cases across the world, palliative care centres reluctantly have felt they've been forced. Often, for instance, governments have refused to support them or provide funding unless they provide assisted suicide or euthanasia. So, and there are a small group of palliative care doctors who are positive about this and who say, you know, yes, we should be able to do both. You know, if people want palliative care, we'll provide palliative care. If they want us to help them to die, we'll help them to die. I think if this is legalised, there will be a huge amount of pressure on the hospices, many of which have a Christian foundation. And I think that the way forward, if this is legalised, is that we should fight very hard to generate assisted dying, quote, free zones, euthanasia free zones, which are safe spaces, both for healthcare professionals, for doctors and nurses and so on, but also safe places for patients. You know, we have a particular logo, we promote, we say we are a euthanasia-free zone. We won't raise the question, you won't be asked, we won't do it. If you want to come here, that's us. Now, I think there will be a huge amount of pressure to prevent that happening, but I think that is the way forward. In fact, I think I would envisage fighting for euthanasia-free zones within NHS hospitals as well. That, you know, we are a significant, those of opposed are a very significant minority of doctors and healthcare professionals, and we're a very significant minority of the population. And we should have our rights, including our religious and philosophical rights, protected. And therefore, we may need to fight hard for that, but I do think that will be essential if this enters into law.
I think that helps. The next question is actually, if the current legislation goes through, do you think Christian doctors should leave the NHS? And I think there's a case to be fought, really, since what you're saying.
Well, actually, can I just talk about that a bit? I think it's up until now, Christian doctors, including myself, have been very proud to work within the NHS and have been very supportive of the NHS. But if you look back into history, there has often been a time when, with a deteriorating society, there comes a point where Christians in all good conscience feel they cannot participate within the society. And at that point, they're forced to withdraw. And I think it's possible that we will start to see the recreation of independent Christian healthcare facilities. I mean, before the foundation of the NHS, there were a whole series of very proud independent Christian hospitals, including the one I trained at, St. Thomas's Hospital in London, St. Bartholomew's, St. Mary's. So it goes on. There were a lot of independent Christian foundations, and they were all merged into the NHS. And unfortunately, they then came under state control. And across the world, there are many independent healthcare facilities, independent Christian healthcare facilities. And I don't see any reason why we couldn't start recreating that in the UK. And I think, to be honest, it might be a significant advance. There would be losses. One of the things that would mean that the Christian influence within the NHS would increasingly diminish with its consequences. I do think if ever independent Christian healthcare facilities were available, the great British public, including, I should think, the Irish public, will beat a path to the door, because they're not stupid and they would probably work out where they might get the best care.
What is the legal balance between the patient and or their next of kin and their doctor to refuse or stop treatment that feels burdensome?
Yes, this is a source of misunderstanding, because I think many relatives feel that it's their right to be able to make decisions on behalf of their loved one. In fact, in English law, they have absolutely no rights at all to make decisions about the care of their loved ones, unless a specific legal process, lasting power of attorney, has been formally undergone. So the duties of doctors are to respect the wishes of patients, if they're competent, if they're legally competent, as much as possible, and to act in their best interests, and to, quote, take into account the views of relatives and friends and so on. But there's no legally binding activity. Having said that, of course, unfortunately, coercive and manipulative relatives are very common. And it sometimes seems as though the euthanasia, pro-euthanasia activists live in an alternative reality where, you know, relatives are always compassionate and infinitely caring and never self-interested and never manipulative. But in the real world, unfortunately, you know, in the law courts and in the social services and in the A&E department and in the NHS, we all know that sometimes relatives can be extremely manipulative and coercive. And therefore, trying to determine whether or not this elderly person is genuinely wishing. And of course, the paradox is there are many older people who are very worried about being a burden to other people. And it's precisely those people who are going to be most at risk of being inadvertently or intentionally coerced to end their lives to help the relatives.
So the next question is really a bit of a request for help. Maybe with the judgment call. I recognise there are a lot of clinicians and Queen's Medic students in the room as well. So one of the questions here has been asked is, where is the boundary between withdrawal of life-providing treatment and assisted suicide, especially in an intensive care context?
Thanks, yes. It's a good question, but I think it's true to say that the boundary is pretty clear in reality, because this boundary has been repeatedly explored in legal test cases in front of judges, barristers, expert witnesses, and so on. And so the boundary is pretty clear between, and it's all about intention. What is your intention in undertaking this action or in withdrawing this treatment or so on? And And that is what is tested, what has been tested in law courts. And therefore, I think it's important. Often, as clinicians, we don't think very carefully about intention. And I think it's a very salutary thing to do on an intensive case. It's something I've done repeatedly. It's sort of got people together and said, let's discuss it. What are we trying to achieve here? What are we aiming to do? Let's clarify our therapeutic intentions. If our intentions is that this person should die, I'm afraid that is homicidal and it is wrong. If our intention is that to stop treatment which is doing no good and which is doing harm, then that is appropriate. Now, sometimes you can argue there is a fine line between that. I think we need to explore our intentions. As a paediatrician, on numerous occasions, I had to take the decision of whether or not to withdraw life-supporting treatment in an extremely premature or brain-damaged baby. And of course, it's a very onerous responsibility to take on in discussion with parents and with colleagues and all the rest. But I was quite clear in my mind that when I withdrew life-supporting treatment, my intention was not to kill. My intention was to stop torturing the patient to no end. And from time to time, I withdrew treatment expecting the baby to die. And rather to my surprise, they said, thank you very much, doctor, I feel a lot better now, and didn't die. Now, if my intention had been to kill, I would have gone to the cupboard and got a lethal poison and done the job cleanly. But my intention, our intention, was not to kill, in which case we provided basic food, nursing care, TLC for the baby, because we weren't trying to kill, we were trying to stop treatment that was bringing no benefit. So I think there is a distinction there. It's contested. There are philosophers and others who would say this is all playing with words. But intention is a foundational concept in morality.
There are a couple of questions that I suppose really asking, is this just a Christian thing? How do we balance Christian morals without imposing on individuals who are not of our faith and wish to experience assisted dying in an inclusive health system? And a kind of follow-up question, do you think arguments against the legislation of assisted dying can be strongly supported from a secular perspective without the mention of God?
Thanks, yeah. And again, it's a question which is often raised. You know, you're imposing your Christian views on the rest of us. I mean, to be honest, this is complete cow cuckoo land. I and you have absolutely no possibility of imposing our views on anybody. We live in a democratic society. Even if I wished to, I couldn't impose my views on anybody else. What we do have is, in a democratic society, we do have the right to free speech. And we have the right to seek to persuade others about the logical basis and the rational arguments in a democratic society. So I have had the privilege of being involved in debates in Parliament and in secular societies. And of course, I don't start with theological anthropology. I mean, the main arguments in the secular world are actually the philosophical arguments about dignity and about human rights and about equality and about protection of the vulnerable. All these carry, in my experience, quite a lot of weight. Coercion, manipulation, abuse, protection. I don't have to use theological or religious arguments. The arguments are mainly to do with prudential reasons, the risks of legislation. The fact that it's only a small minority who are pushing for this, and yet we're going to jeopardize thousands of vulnerable people to respect their wishes. Those kind of arguments. I think it is perfectly possible to make these arguments, and we should be making these arguments. And if people tell us that we're imposing our views, well, for goodness sake, everyone else in social media is trying to impose their views. Why shouldn't Christians be a part of that debate? Of expressing our beliefs and values.
John, one of the things you mentioned about suffering was that it's not just physical pain, sometimes it's spiritual pain, and there's a question here around palliative care chaplains and how they've been replaced elsewhere, but how would you suggest that we promote and preserve spiritual care here in this region? Do you see that it's declining in England in the face of this argument?
It's a very interesting question about spiritual care. The interesting thing is that in many areas of medicine, spiritual care and spiritual reasons have been rediscovered. I mean, for instance, in psychiatry, there is much greater awareness among secular psychiatrists about the importance of spiritual issues in the expression of mental illness and so on. It's not, I think we can argue strongly, and in fact there's a whole evidence base about the importance of spiritual issues, not just at the end of life, but across the whole spectrum of illness and disease and different kinds of problems. So we can point to the evidence base, and we should argue very strongly, for what Cicely Saunders said, and that is, spiritual stroke, existential pain is one of the commonest reasons for people expressing distress at the end of life, this deep existential distress. And it doesn't respond to morphine. It doesn't respond to opioids. Surprise, surprise. But it can respond to compassionate, thoughtful, gentle, spiritual care. And Cicely Saunders actually designed her custom-built hospice at St. Christopher's. She put the chapel in the centre of the building, and it was designed so all the clinical areas, patients could be pushed, however sick they were in their beds, they could be pushed into the chapel. And there was the daily cycle of worship, interdenominational Christian worship in the chapel, and people could receive the Eucharist and so on. She demonstrated the centrality of spiritual care. Sadly, that has been under attack. And so I think it has to be fought for, and we have to understand our heritage and fight to maintain it.
Thank you, John. I'll just one or two to finish, if that's okay. A practical question for you. Will a patient's request for euthanasia still be subject to best interest test, or if it meets the legislative guidance, will autonomy override clinical judgment?
It's a very good question, and this is part of the issues that at this very moment I've no doubt that lawyers and administrators and others are wrestling with, how to reframe medical law and practice. Because this is potentially a hugely deforming, up until now, there's been a very coherent structure of understanding best interests. And this legislation, I think, produces a profound deformation of a coherent body of law. And how they're going to resolve it, I don't know. It's squaring the circle, how you can have a traditional appeal to best interest, but also say, but you can kill yourself under these circumstances. Even if I think that's a terrible thing, as a doctor, I can't be forced to do the deed myself, but I can't stop someone else, even a colleague, coming and doing the deed.
A last question, then I'm going to slightly piggyback on it. The last question I'm going to share with you is how do we make people feel they have dignity as they near the end of life? The most important thing to me is always students and how do we equip them for the life beyond university. So even to the undergraduates in this room, what advice would you give in that line? How would you encourage them to help people feel that they have dignity, where this is a question that's pressing on their mind?
It's a great question. You know, there's a real skill that you can learn as a clinician of how to make people feel they're being respected. And if you're a student or a resident doctor, you should look for the senior doctors who know how to do it. Not all senior doctors are good at this. But there are some doctors who know how to do it, and you should watch how they do it and learn from them. But fundamentally, it involves showing, demonstrating by my behavior that I believe you are worth as much as I am. You're as important as I am. In fact, you're more important than I am. I'm the consultant, but you are more important. You're my patient. That means I spend time with you. I get down to your level. I look into your eyes. If appropriate, and it often is, I put a hand or an arm. I express my concern. I show I'm listening to you. I'm prepared to sit in silence. I'm attentive to what you want to tell me. I'm showing that I'm taking you seriously. And I'm trying to demonstrate by my body language as much as by my words, this is what respect looks like. And for those of us who are Christians, it's trying to be Jesus in the situation. You know, as Christian clinicians, we are called to see Jesus in our patients, to treat them as though they were Jesus. We are called to be Jesus, to behave as he would if he was in this situation. And you can learn to do it better. There's always more to learn, but it's one of the greatest gifts you can give to anyone. Talking about dignity, there was an incident. A friend of mine, some years ago, she was working as a palliative care nurse in a big cancer hospital. And she'd got very close to a particular older man who was dying of cancer. And she was off one evening, and she came back the following morning, and she went up to his bed and she says, "How are you? How was the night?" And he said, "I'm afraid I wet the bed." And then he started weeping. And she sort of put, "Oh no, it doesn't matter. We're very used to people weeping in the bed." She said, no, it wasn't that. It was the way I was treated by the nurse. The way she treated me so lovingly, so compassionately, and it just made me weep. So that's what it means. That's what it looks like. And it's powerful. And it's life-changing. And it's Christ-like.
Of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Mercy Ships is transforming lives across Africa through medical training and free surgery. Joining me is Dr. Manjeet Dhillon, a volunteer surgeon. Dr. Manjeet, for anyone who doesn't know, what does Mercy Ships actually do?
Mercy Ships is a faith-based charity who deploy hospital ships to some of the poorest parts of the world. And our hospital ship will dock for several months in places where people simply can't access safe surgery. On board, we have everything you would find in a modern hospital. Patients are offered world-class surgery completely free of charge. And at the same time, we train local doctors and nurses so they can keep providing care after we're gone.
You must have met so many people whose lives have been changed. Are there any that stayed with you?
On a recent visit to Madagascar, I met 2-year-old Armella. She was born with a grapefruit-sized tumour behind her ear. Her mum prayed every day that someone would help her. And when our ship arrived, myself and other medical and nursing volunteers from around the world removed the tumour free of charge. Now Armella is healthy, happy and full of life.
And how can listeners help more people like Armella?
Right now, every gift is being matched pound for pound up to 400,000. Your generosity could help a child get the surgery they've been waiting for or help train a nurse or doctor to change lives for years to come.
Thank you, Dr. Manjeet.
If you'd like to help transform more lives like Armella's, visit mercyships.org.uk/premier.